Inside the Boss Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Lacrosse Industry Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by a very special guest, James Maselli, the principal of Epic Lacrosse. And this is a little bit of a different version of the Industry Podcast versus what you have heard to this point. This is the first in a series of conversations that will run up to our January Lacrosse Industry Summit, the second iteration of the summit, the first being held in May in Philadelphia around the Final Four. And hopefully you have caught up on those podcasts to prepare yourself for what I expect to be, James, a very enriching conversation about a personality who is helping to drive the industry of lacrosse, as well as a business who has gone through an explosive growth trajectory, as well as a guy who has his finger on the pulse of the industry at large. So thank you for joining us.
Well, Terry, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, let's start by learning a little bit more about you. I think that it's always helpful to understand a person's background as you put their perspective into context. And you're a Long Island native. You are an Adelphi alum, and something that I don't know if a conversation passes without you, advocating for Division II lacrosse. And that's something that I really respect. Definitely a guy who cherishes his roots. How did lacrosse shape your life and your professional career as you, kind of grew up and developed into the organizational leader that you are today?
Well, Terry, first off, I can't imagine where I would be in life if it wasn't for lacrosse. I started at a very early age, got my first stick for Christmas. It was for those who are gear nuts, it was a quick stick with brown leathers. And I got it for Christmas when I was 9 years old. And it literally, from that point forward, it's almost before lacrosse and after lacrosse. It's been unbelievable. It's something that, from a passion standpoint, I caught the bug on day one. Was outside trying to catch the ball against the wall. Drove my parents crazy for, some odd years of bouncing the ball upstairs in the house. Broke a lot of windows, a lot of siding. But really just found, the first love of my life at a very early age. And you know what? You mentioned D2 lacrosse. I love the fact that I played D2 lacrosse at Adelphi. The fact of the matter is as much as I wanted to go to Syracuse and Maryland, the genetic makeup just wouldn't let it be possible. But I found a very good, competitive environment at Adelphi. I had an opportunity to play in four national championships, winning two. Some of the greatest teammates and people I've ever met happened those 4 years. And you know what? I've taken lacrosse and I've tried to maximize it as far as I can, but also try to give back as much as I can and continue to coach today. And then, of course, at Epic, just trying to, move the game forward through innovation and technology. So from 9 years old to today, and I'm just a tick under 40. It's been an incredible and instrumental part of my life.
And, moving on to some of the elements of your career prior to, becoming a part and a founding component of Epic Lacrosse, you spent the about 5 years of your career with Pioneer Electronics. And I'm curious, obviously there's, in terms of a consumer-facing product, a lot of overlap. But I would imagine a lot that's very distinct about that industry and lessons that you were able to take away from it and bring to lacrosse. So, very plainly, what were some of those lessons?
Well, when I was at Pioneer, I had a mentor. He's still a mentor to me today in both family and business. His name is Russ Johnston, and he was the EVP of marketing at Pioneer. And, he's someone that I learned so much from, mainly how to build a brand and what is behind a brand. It's relatively easy to put product in the market, but to build a brand from the ground up is a unique skill. And he still blows me away of how he's able to take a product and create a story around it and explain to consumers what that story is and what's the passion behind it. And that's something that, I try to instill in my employees, and it's what we're doing here at Epic Lacrosse. But I was at Pioneer at a very, very interesting time. when I started, 50-inch flat panel TVs were about $18,000. And in about five short years, that went all the way down to about, when I left, I think it was like $39.99. So $4,000 for a 50-inch flat panel TV. So consumer electronics teaches you a lot of lessons. It's the only industry in the world that I know of that products come out that are bigger, faster, and stronger, and cheaper. So you're constantly monitoring the market. Competition is fierce. And the retailers, you have to develop very good partnerships with the retailers in order for your product to get noticed. So it was trial by fire, but I loved every minute of it. I missed the company and I missed the people. I don't miss getting up on Sundays and looking at the Best Buy Sunday circular to see if your competition is 15, 20, or 30% cheaper than you are, and having all the stress that goes with that. But work in consumer electronics and work with the people at Pioneer, in particular Russ, was an amazing experience. And I'm in meetings and I hear myself saying things that Russ said to me, 5, 10 years ago. So it's had a pretty big effect in my life.
And shifting the focus to Epic, the company was born in 2010. Where did the idea come from?
Good question. There's several different avenues of the story, but I'll sort of key on the one. Coming from the CE world, technology and innovation is something that drives it. And I was really sort of intrigued by the way Apple came out of nowhere and was a computer company and all of a sudden became a lifestyle company that was making CE goods, consumer electronics goods, in your everyday life. And they took over the audio space and the video space and very, very quickly. So I was always intrigued with innovation. I also, at the time, was living out in Los Angeles and was doing a fair amount of cycling. And I was very, very impressed by the cycling industry and their use of materials and design and innovation from generation to generation of products. In particular, I was very fascinated by carbon fiber. And I remember when I was playing and I was at Adelphi in the late 90s, there were a couple products that came out that touted carbon fiber technology. And I know that even when I finished school and don't want to say I was out of the game, but wasn't probably in it as much as I am today, I know that carbon fiber sort of, reared its head every once in a while, but never really had that mass sort of product takeover. And I looked at it and said, the game of lacrosse really hasn't changed much from, 98, 99 when I played. It was the same products, just sort of skin slightly different. The graphic packages, when we first started Epic, was the main driver of a new product launch from the previous year. It's like, hey, check it out. Now it comes in blue. And it was basically the same product. So when I looked at it, I said, wow, the sport I love is sort of in the dark ages. And things haven't really changed, since the offset head and the titanium shaft came out in, 92 and 96. And when we looked at it, a tremendous opportunity, a business opportunity, to say, hey, here's a way to grow the game of lacrosse that I love, be involved in the game, and develop products and satisfy that passion, and develop products that the game hasn't seen. If you look at almost every other sport, from cycling to tennis to golf to hockey, I can go on and on and on. The adoption of high-end materials like carbon fiber happened, 10 years ago. I think the last player to use a titanium shaft in the NHL was about 6 years ago. So it was 100% adoption. So that's pretty quick. But yet the sport that, even today, the sport that I love, carbon fiber is still only about 7% of the, about 10% of the handle market. I think if you talk to your retailers that you may know, they'll tell you that it's probably the fastest growing category. So it certainly has legs and it's hitting there. But It's almost shocking that it took so long for it to happen. So the idea for Epic was born out of the necessity for more technology and sort of advancement of products, at least in my mind. And incidentally, the name Epic means a new beginning or a new era. So when we were looking to name the company, we're like, well, this is a new era. This is a, you know, this is a new start of technology in the game. And the name Epic seemed to fit really, really well.
One of the things that I take away from that is that the origin story is very important for creating the identity of any organization, brand, or product. And I think that it's a tremendous asset for Epic that you guys are able to point very directly at your raison d'etre, your reason for being. And it's that you saw a need in the marketplace for carbon fiber shafts. How much do you guys consider that an asset off of which you can build, you know, the rest of what has become a much more diversified organization?
You know, I would take it a little bit beyond. I think carbon fiber was the driver, and it might be the visual cue that is the connection between the brand. But for us, it's really technology innovation. In fact, we think of ourselves as a technology and design company that makes lacrosse equipment, as opposed to a sporting goods or lacrosse equipment manufacturer that utilizes good design and technology. We start everything with design, technology, and innovation. So, you know, I think carbon fiber is, like I said, is that visual cue. I think it's been very, very important to who we are. It's part of our brand language, and we talk about it every day, and you know, how it aligns with our mission, vision, and core values as a company. You know, certainly carbon fiber is in technology and design is echoed throughout that quite a bit.
So individually, how do you identify your role in the development? You know, your title is principal of Epic Lacrosse. So, you know, I guess, again, a very plain question. What does that mean? And what was it like being a part of the, you know, kind of planting of the seeds of Epic Lacrosse?
It's been one of the most gratifying and challenging things I've ever done in my life. I firmly believe to surround yourself with people that are smarter than you. And anybody who has an opportunity to meet my my team will certainly tell you that. You know, from the likes of a Ryan Hurley, a Cornell educated Midwest guy, just salt of the earth. You know, being a business partner to you know the rest of the organization. You know, a key guy like a Brian Hockman, who I coached at University of Minnesota Duluth, an MCLA team. In terms of you know, when you play club lacrosse. And you have to pay and play, and you have virtually no support often from your university. You find people that have a strong desire and passion and love for this game. And if you look at our organization, you're going to find people with diverse backgrounds from, you know, Division One playing in front of the largest crowd in Division One history, to guys with pro experience down to MCLA Division One and Division Two. So. You know, my role is just to try to corral everybody and provide some direction. But the great ideas and the brilliance of creating a brand and everything else is coming from the team. And like I said, my job is to make sure that we don't mess it up and that the energy is going in the right direction. And maybe bring in some of the, a perspective and business acumen of being in, the industry, or being involved in an industry for over 10 years versus, you know, my team that has an average age of 24. You know, that's my role, is just to make sure we're I always use the analogy. I know we're all in the same canoe. I just want to make sure we're all rowing in the right direction. So I just try to I'm the ringleader, if you will. But all the talent and ideas, and it's coming, you know, large in part from our team.
And that dovetails or segues nicely into, you know, one of the questions that I think, when I imagine who listens to this type of podcast, I imagine it's, you know, a lot of young men and women who have an idea for something that they think the lacrosse market needs or have already started to put pen to paper. And one of the things that I think is the most important to figure out how to battle is the feeling of fear, whether it's fear of failure or pretty much that's it. Fear of failure. And so the question I have for you is, you know, do you have any memories of at the early stages, the most exciting moments of you know, the most exciting moments or the most significant pangs of fear, and how did you overcome them? How did you harness them, and how did you utilize them?
Well, first of all, if anybody's listened to this and they have entrepreneurial desires and, you know, they want to design the next great lacrosse glove or head or shaft, I say do it. Just go ahead and do it. You know, I'm sure there's great ideas that are sitting in someone's drawer, you know, from 100 years ago. I was the kid that, you know, was drawing pictures of lacrosse heads and coming up with product concepts when I was 9, 10 years old. And I still have some of those pieces of paper here in the office. You know, if that's what you want to do and that's what drives you, I would say do it. In terms of what the fears are, you know, the fears that I had, you know, 6 years ago are the exact same fears that I wake up with today. You know, it's the things that I relish. I love the challenge of being an entrepreneur. But the things that keep me up at night haven't really changed. It's just a much bigger scale. You know, you wonder if you put a product out there, whether it's a new product or a different price point, is it going to work? What is your competition up to? Are they, you know, trying to copy your technology? Are they developing something new and better? All those types of fears. What happens if we sell into a retailer but it doesn't sell out? Or what happens if we push technology too far and all of a sudden failure rates go up? All those types of issues is literally part of my notebook from 6 years ago and things that I think about today. It hasn't really, really changed. But those same things that scare you also what drives you, and it's also what motivates you to do things better and get you excited when you have wins. You know, we were sort of chatting offline before, but, you know, we're having unprecedented sell-through on some new products. Our Dragonfly 7 is nearly sold out and is sold out in some of our largest retail partners. And our new protective line, the Integra line that we launched a week before Black Friday, can't be found in certain places. And we're just, you know, we're waiting for additional inventory to come to keep feeding the channel. Did we plan for success? Yes. Were we a little conservative? Maybe. But even at the level of success we're having right now, I don't think we ever would have been able to predict it, nor have our retail partners. So within that same breath, there's success. And then there's, as an entrepreneur and a business owner, there's lost sales there. Did I do something wrong? Did we not do a good job? So it's a constant battle. I don't know the exact expression, but it's something along the lines of an entrepreneur is the only person in the world that's willing to work 90 hours a week to avoid working 40. And it's 100% true. You know, my wife thinks that I'm attached to my phone, and she's probably right. But, you know, or hours of the night, ideas and concepts and emails, I'm checking them. I'm infamous for waking up at 2:30 in the morning and going to sit at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee until the kids wake up and we start breakfast, because there's just an idea or a concept or something's bugged me or I just didn't get something done. So if that's someone's drive and they want to be involved in a product and have a passion, I say do it. Go ahead and do it, whether it's in pet food, whether it's in lacrosse equipment, or whether it's an app. I say go and do it. There is no greater satisfaction then walking into a retailer, walking into an environment where your product is being used and people love it. So I think if you ever get to the point where it stops being scary, then it's maybe time to move on. It should be scary. It's kind of like having kids. It's really, really scary, but it's the absolute best reward you'll ever have in your life.
Well, that's it kind of brings up the, you know, a natural follow-up, which is, have you ever experienced, or what was the moment that you experienced that felt like maybe a tipping point where, you know, you were able to kind of transition from the first phase of, are we going to make it, to the second phase of, we know we're not going anywhere, but how do we then, you know, identify our next set of goals and make sure that we achieve them? Was there a moment where you felt like you transitioned, you know, from the precarious nature of existence into the, you know, maybe more challenging nature of optimization?
So I don't know if we feel like we're firmly established yet. I think we're constantly driving for that. And in a lot of ways, Terry, I hope we never feel that. I always want us to feel like a startup. I've heard Jeff Bezos say that from Amazon. It's just to continually have that entrepreneurial spirit and continually want to grow and move forward and expand. There was a moment about 6 months into it where Ryan and I looked at each other and we said, okay, this is working. What's next? You know, we started a company and yeah, we wanted to do everything. We wanted to do heads and protective and the whole deal. But, you know, you start with shafts and you put down a fair amount of capital to get started in that and in R&D in the front end and then some product in the middle and you work on selling it. And we had a lot of sort of moments where our retailers were not very excited about carbon fiber. There's been brands in the past that introduced carbon fiber products and just didn't work. It just didn't live up to the durability. And it was quite a bit of a challenge to get some selling. It's one of the reasons why we have a one-year warranty on our products is to say, hey, trust us. We stand behind these. This is something that's different. And we'd had retailers call us up and say, all right, I'll try five. And we'd send them five on a Friday, and we get a phone call Monday, and they'd be like, I sold all five. Send me 10. And then they would get a call, call the next week and say, we sold all 10. Send me 30. And we had this sort of success in lots of different places. And we looked at each other and said, okay, this is working. Our vision is starting to work. What's next? But I don't think we've ever looked at it in the sense of, okay, now we're established. You know, we don't spend a whole lot of time looking at our competition. We care more about what's happened within our four walls. But we want to beat our competitors every single day. We want to beat SDX. We want to beat Warrior. We want to beat Maverick. We want to beat String King and Greg over at ECD. You know, we know those guys. We like them. We respect the hell out of them. But we want to beat them. I think one of the greatest things in our sport is after a hard-fought battle, we all line up and shake hands after every single game. I think that's really great. You know, having a beer with someone like Greg and then all of a sudden, you know, they're introducing their products, we're introducing ours, and we're battling out. I think that's great. I love it. But I don't think we ever say, okay, we've made it. Because I think once you feel that, you start to rest. And we're not ready to rest. We still have a lot more planned.
I want to come back to some more specifics about Epic, but you brought up a topic that I think now's a good time to address, and it does correlate to the point that you made about if you feel compelled to make a better lacrosse glove and you want to lead that entrepreneurial effort, go ahead. That's your advice to somebody out there. And then you talk about the nature of competition within this industry and this category. You know, one of the comments that you hear is that it's oversaturated in the sense that there are too many companies, there are too many players in the market, and there's too much product in the marketplace. Do you agree with that? And if so, how does it impact your strategy?
I think if you look at it from through a particular lens, I think it's really easy to make that argument. We don't look at it through that lens. I think, you know, competition breeds innovation, and innovation will win. It always does. So I think where some of those gripes and some of these are coming from are maybe come from the point of view of, hey, we used to be on top, and now there's a lot of competition. We need to put pressure on the retailers to maybe not carry some of these newer brands, or, you know, to carry this product or to carry more of my product. But over time, that strategy just doesn't work. Innovation wins at the end of the day. So I think will there be some changes? Will there be some potential mergers and acquisitions? And is the market going to shift and change? Absolutely. We were talking earlier about my experience in consumer electronics. There was a point in time where Sony was the king. It was the absolute king. They made the best this, the best that. They invented the Walkman. You know, Sony was the king of that industry. Now it's Apple and Samsung. Nobody would have predicted that. Are there too many, you know, cell phones and TVs on the market? Absolutely, if you look at it from the viewpoint of a particular lens. But I also think that increased competition is what's driving innovation. And I think we're seeing the same thing right now in the lacrosse space. You look at the brands that are taking risks on composite technology. They're the younger brands. They're the newer brands. It's sort of the new era of product that's coming in. They're innovating, you know, or I should say we're innovating. And I think some of the legacy products and the legacy brands, They either have to react or they're, you know, it's just not going to work out, at least in my opinion, the same way. So, you know, I think the innovation that's a result of sort of increased competition is really what you know, it drives entrepreneurs. I think that's what drives capitalism. I think it's great. More the merrier. And, you know, and the sort of challenge to, you know, to go out there and build a better glove is not to say, you know, you can't build one better than us. It's saying, God, we still love this game. You know, everybody in this office, we want to build the best product, but, you know, we love the game and we want to see new and cool things be introduced. And if that's what pushes us to go to the next level, I want to see it. And I want to see it tomorrow. I don't want to see it in 10 years. I want to see it tomorrow. What is the next thing? Let's see it out there. Let's evaluate it. And then that challenges my team to come out with something better. And I believe that's how business should work. So, yeah, I think there are some naysayers in the industry right now. And I think you can get really analytical and look at things and compare it to the glory days and the golden days of the sport and say, it's too much of this, too much of that, not enough of this. Or you could look at it and say, boy, there's a lot of competition out there right now. I wonder who's going to win. So maybe that's a unique approach. I don't know, but that's what gets us up every day. And that's how we sort of look at the industry as a whole.
If that's the point of view, then it probably puts in a heavier emphasis than normal on partnerships. And, yeah, you know, create, whether it's to assist innovation or to help penetrate the marketplace. And particularly for, you know, a brand like Epic that is 6 years old, that came to market with a product that, you know, by some definition of the word was revolutionary. Helping adoption was essential. Who have been some of the most significant partners in Epic's development?
You know, first and foremost, I would have to say it's the retailers. Retailers have a very, very tough business. It's, you know, we just talked about competition. Retail environment right now is extremely competitive. Retail is changing. It's shifting. You know, we all know about bricks and mortar and going to .com and everything else. So for retail to take a risk on a new brand, that risk is magnified. If they get stuck with that product and that kills their cash flow, that's a lot to take on. The retailers that bought in early and understood the vision and believed in the vision, you know, those were great partners. And, you know, and I would say 90% of those we still have today. And, you know, we're really grateful for them taking the opportunity to try this, you know, new brand and sort of a new technology. But we've had, you know, in our entire supply chain, we work very, very hard on building different partners. Even on the innovation side, you know, we have partners in town here that are doing the latest and greatest 3D printing technologies. And, you know, through the lacrosse community and through some connections, we were able to connect with them early on. Being able to 3D print ahead, which, you know, a lot of people are doing now. It's nothing new. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, it was still sort of this esoteric technology. And we sort of had access to it and allowed us to prototype different types of parts that before we went ahead and cut a, you know, $60,000, $70,000 piece of steel to make a mold for a head, we were able to sort of prove out concepts. So even the little partnerships along the supply chain with manufacturers, with retailers, with, you know, different part of the supply chain have been vital to our business, you know, all the way down to our media partners. You know, we launched a brand at the NCAA Final Four in 2011, and Ryan Hurley knew somebody who worked at Inside Lacrosse. We didn't know anybody. And we made a phone call, and we begged for some photos, and we came down, and I'll never forget, we were introduced. At the time, it was Jeff Dudley and Ryan Rabideau was there. Terry, I can't remember if you and I met that day or not, but we came in and we brought some handles and you guys got the camera out and you gave us some, FaceTime. And you know, all of a sudden we were legitimized cause we were on Inside Lacrosse.
Remember that. Yeah, it was, I was in the mix. I probably had longer sideburns and maybe a little bit more hair. That might be why you can't remember it. Cause I probably looked a little bit different.
Well, I'm sure I had a lot more hair back then too, but You know, those are all the partnerships and things that we're incredibly grateful for. You know, it takes a village. It really does. And, you know, there's people and individuals, and then there's organizations that we're grateful for. And, you know, I think, you know, some of the retailers that took a risk on us, I think they've benefited from having the Epic brand as well. So I think it's been a nice mutual partnership there where everybody's benefiting. But there's a lot of people along the way that have certainly helped, and we're incredibly grateful for them.
Well, you mentioned taking a village, and you've spoken already about the staff within your walls and their connectivity to the sport and how important that is to the identity of Epic. But, you know, another element is that you're based in Minnesota, you know, which is a in some respects an outpost of lacrosse, but in other respects certainly a burgeoning hotbed. How important is being in Minnesota to the identity of the brand and to your business?
Oh, excellent question, Terry. I got to be honest. I think initially there was a benefit of being based in Minnesota. We took a very unique approach of launching our brand instead of heading out to the East Coast and saying, hey, check out our new products. We did things completely different. We started here in the Midwest and in the West Coast. One of our first partners was a company called Southwell Sports. They morphed into Adrenaline and are no longer in existence. They were, I think they were purchased by Lacrosse Limited about 3-4 years ago. But we started a brand on the West Coast and the Midwest, and really got some brand loyalty and some following. And, you know, part of the reasons why we did it is, you know, you grow up in Long Island, you have your dad, your uncle, your brother, your sister, your cousin. They say, hey, this is the brand I grew up playing with. This is what you should use. When we went out to the Midwest and you know, out to the West Coast, it was like kids coming home with permission slips saying they signed up for lacrosse, and the parents are like, I know nothing about this. So the opportunity for a new brand to be successful was greatly enhanced. Eventually, when we built up enough momentum and then we started calling the retailers on the East Coast, the buyers had the attitude of, hey, you know what? We had people asking about you. I was curious when you were going to call us, as opposed to, hey, I got 16 people a week trying to pitch their new brand to me. You know, I don't have time for you. So we sort of, you know, everything that we've been doing is to really build a brand and to build that foundation, not to go get that really quick, cheap sale. So, you know, being in the Midwest was sort of beneficial for us, because I also think our competition didn't pay attention to us. You know, we have some intel that, you know, weekly meetings and some of our competition was like, hey, there's this brand out in California that's doing really, really well called Epic. Truthfully, they probably called it Epoch and didn't know how to pronounce it, but that's okay too. And we were just so far off the radar screen that I don't think our competition noticed until we ended up at some of the larger retailers on the East Coast and we became the, you know, the top selling shaft, or the, you know, we had two of the five in the first month or two, and it was like, uh-oh, we should have paid attention to them. So I think it's been a beneficial. I also made a comment earlier about, you know, guys who play in the MCLA and their passion for the game in a lot of instances is just as strong, if not stronger, than someone who's playing for a Tier 1 Division 1 team. You know, the same thing we said for people playing in the Midwest. You know, there's a bit of a chip on the shoulder of saying, hey, We have lacrosse too. You know, I love the game just as much, and I fell for the game just as much. You know, just because I'm here in Minneapolis versus, you know, where I grew up in Long Island, doesn't mean you love it more. It's just, you know, it's just sort of a different environment. So, you know, I think there's a being the brand and sort of being the new brand and maybe some of the people that have working here. It's, you know, we have maybe the world against us sort of attitude, and we're fighting hard, and we wake up with that attitude every single day. In terms of love of the game, it's actually kind of funny. We find ourselves huddled around a laptop watching a clip of a video that maybe our competitors put on, or maybe someone on Instagram, of a really cool trick shot or a really nice goal or something a pro did. We are doing the exact same things that our customers are doing. We're just doing it in a work environment, and, you know, we're sort of having fun. And I think if we were in Baltimore or Long Island or in New England or whatever, I don't think we'd be any different, except for maybe it's still a little bit of a chip on our shoulder saying, hey, don't ignore us too.
It's an interesting dynamic, and I think that, you know, one of the things that compels me the most about it is, you know, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, which, you know, I make no secret about. You're from Long Island. I live in Baltimore. You live in Minnesota. We've had inverse perspectives on our relationship to the sport from a hotbed, non-hotbed perspective. For me, I think that, you know, what has long been an asset for Inside Lacrosse is how much of our kind of staff and workforce comes at it from a non-lacrosse-centric perspective. You know, I think that at the time that Inside Lacrosse, you know, took some steps forward in separating itself from the lacrosse media landscape, one of the things that was a market differentiator was that, you know, we were people who had a professional background in media but had a, you know, passion point for lacrosse, as opposed to so much of our competition being, you know, folks who had a background in lacrosse but maybe had a passion point for media, or, you know, probably most likely felt that, you know, they were going to embark on this endeavor because lacrosse deserved something more than the attention that it was being paid by the mainstream media. You know, whereas you kind of have a little bit of the inverse in the sense that you came from and understood the mindset of the hotbed player very acutely, but was living in a world where, you know, you saw opportunity in your marketplace to do things differently and to be maybe a little bit better, if not, you know, simply for the sake, different for the sake of being different. But I think what's compelling to me about that is also the way in which you've been able to utilize some of the, you know, kind of industry stalwarts, so to speak, you know, in terms of setting a path or bouncing off guidance. You've already, you know, spoken about one of your mentors from Pioneer. In the past, you have spoken about your relationship with John Gagliardi and you know, one of the founders of Maverick Lacrosse. I think that it's difficult to miss the fact that Maverick was founded as a shaft company as well, and, you know, had a product in the Wonder Boy that I think ended up, you know, becoming a part of the signature of that brand in much the same way the Dragonfly has with Epic. So I'm curious as to whether or not there's anything about what the trajectory of Maverick held that fans of the Epic brand or followers of the lacrosse industry, you know, could take away as clues. Or do you feel like, you know, maybe your paths ahead are you know, quite divergent at this point?
Yeah. So I'll start with John Gagliardi. He's been excellent. Truth be told, I sent John Gagliardi an email probably about 8 years ago asking him for a job. I was my role at Pioneer was to manage the Best Buy and Amazon business, so I had this national account experience, and I sent him an email and said, hey, I'd love to take this experience and put it into the lacrosse world. And, you know, hey, I'm Italian, you're Italian, what do you think? You know, he respectfully declined. Come to find out afterwards that they were in negotiations to sell the company. So bringing on any additional headcount was probably, you know, not in the cards, unless he just didn't like my resume and he just was being too kind. But since that, he's been incredibly grateful and, you know, if I have questions, introductions with retailers, you know, he's just been a great mentor. And I'll get the motivational text of, hey, like what you're doing, you know, keep at it, you know, those types of things. So John has been great. In terms of our trajectory versus Maverick, I think the only reason why we're aware of it is because of what retailers tell us. Hey, this is how this brand started, or this is how this brand started. But we don't have, we didn't start with a business plan and say, hey, this worked for these guys, let's copy it. I think there's probably a lot of more coincidence there than anything else. But we have a high level of respect for Maverick and what they've been able to attain. And if people want to make that comparison, we're going to be okay with it.
You mentioned, obviously, the distinctions and differentiations between Maverick and Epic, and one that comes to mind for me is the you know, the negotiations that they were in, and I don't know whether those were the same ones that eventually led to the sale to Performance Sports Group or not, but that ended up happening and certainly set the course for Maverick. And one of the things that I admire the most about the approach that you've taken to diversifying the business of Epic is the development of, I guess, for lack of a better term, that I have, you know, a sister company, so to speak, in C6 Composites that's able to draw on the expertise that you guys have developed in dealing with composites and particularly carbon fiber, you know, and finding potential other uses and utilizations of it. I love it because it seems like the type of thing that is it not only, you know, creates a foundation and a stability for Epic as a business, but it also, you know, calls to the forefront the truth of the comment that you made about being a technology and design company that creates lacrosse equipment as opposed to being a sporting good company that utilizes technology and design. Mm-hmm. It strikes me as a relatively unique thing. To whatever degree you can talk about it, and I would understand if there are certain elements that are proprietary, you know, what is the idea behind the way that you guys structured it, and you know, what are, you know, some of the goals that you have for having multiple companies, a duality of companies, so to speak, moving forward?
Yeah, you know, I think the driver was it is composite technology and the materials that, you know, carbon fiber materials and other types of materials are evolving so quickly. It's unbelievable. You know, aluminum or alloys have been such a mainstay in industry in the United States for such a long time, and now we're starting to see it be replaced by carbon fiber. So the innovation and the time and the energy that's going into the material sciences, the application of the material, the resins, the processing, all that stuff is literally changing by the day. And what we found is when we were overseas having our manufacturing is that we were here in the U.S. learning about some new things and new techniques, and we wanted to implement it. And it was just really, really hard for, you know, suppliers to adapt and change. This is the way we do things. Here's the equipment we own. This is how we build it. It has to sort of fit within this framework. And you know, our culture here, one of our core values is to push buttons, you know, try some new things and expand upon it. And I guess just sort of out of the frustration of the slow innovation as a result of manufacturing, sent us down a path to say, well, what if we just build ourselves? I mean, it was literally a question that easy, and I'll never forget it was over Chipotle, and we're like, well, what if we just did this ourselves? And we started to wrangle the pieces together, and we found that with the proper investment, we could. And you know, I think the you know, the fruits of the labor are evident just by our Gen 7 success that we're having here in the first 4 months. I mean, you know, business is up over 40% over last year, and we can't fill orders. So who knows what the top is? We can't really put our finger on it right now. So I think when you look at the culture that we're in right now in terms of Americans and our need for technology, you know, everybody has their advanced cell phone and computers and laptops and iPads. Today's consumer, including maybe even the younger consumer that is interested in lacrosse equipment, is hyper aware of technology and the technology message and understand it, respect it. So for us, it was like, how do we make good on what our, you know, core mission and vision is? And that's to bring technology. And one way to do it is to actually control and vertically integrate our manufacturing. I'm on the phone with you right now, one of our conference rooms. But if I walk 10 feet to my left, I'm in the finishing room where they're decaling, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shafts today. I take a few more steps and I'm in the layup room where we're cutting raw carbon fiber and laying it up and putting it into molds. And if I walk a little bit further down, you'll see where they're actually going through the presses and they're being sanded and painted. You know, it's all happening right here, and we can overlook that. We can control it. Things pop up. We can address issues a lot quicker versus an overseas manufacturer. Incidentally, we're oversold in a lot of areas. Well, we have full control of increase in output of that factory to sort of meet the demand. But to kind of go back full circle to your question was, we knew that by doing it ourselves, would allow us to be market leaders in this technology. And we are full in on this technology. We believe that composite handles will have more than 50% market share by the year 2020. We think more players than not will be using carbon fiber. It's kind of interesting, a little bit of a side note. If you look at like one of the top selling heads in the game right now, it's the Nike CEO with the Lakota, which came out in 2010. But it took almost 5 to 10, you know, it almost took 5 to 6 years for it to become that number one selling head. And we sort of did some research on it, and we realized that when they did the rules change on the heads and the dimensions, which that head was sort of part of that, the first batch of heads that came out after that, it became really, really popular in sort of that in the younger generation. And although you didn't see it on ESPN, you didn't see it on TV, you didn't see the big schools using it for those first couple of years, by the time that that generation had started using it, grew up and they went through high school and they started making their way into college, then all of a sudden that head became a mainstay on the college elite level. What we're seeing now is the same thing with composite technology, where, you know, we first started, we were selling a lot of handles, you know, to that sort of middle school and to that high school group. And then, you know, we get a few college guys and a few premier high school guys that would take it. Now those guys are in the college ranks, and that's what they're using. And, you know, there's lots of contracts out there, and it's kind of hard to say who and why, where is your product being used. And I think some of the real gearheads who look on Instagram can notice where product's being used. But there's composite technology that's being used in the national championship game last year. That probably never happened before. It's all sort of growing up with the technology. So as these high school kids right now that are dominating, and that's what they're buying, as they get into college and you start to see it, you know, at the elite levels the next couple of years, by 2020, 50% of the lacrosse shafts sold are going to be composite technology. It's happening. It's evident by our competition starting to introduce their composite technology in their product lineups. So for us to really be the leaders and to control that and to make sure that we don't lose ground, we decided to build ourselves. And we surrounded ourselves with some of the most talented engineers that we knew. They believed in what we wanted to accomplish. And, you know, we're set up today that if we're driving in and we have a concept or an idea that we want to test, we can design it, build it, test it within hours. That's unheard of with Chinese manufacturing or overseas manufacturing or, you know, even down in Mexico and some of the other countries. It's literally in our same office building. So that's what drives our company. We made that investment because we believe in the technology, and we believe that in order to lead it, we need to have it vertically integrated with our company. And that's where we spent our investment and some dollars. And it's a beautiful facility. I know that, Terry, you've come down here with some of your crew and walked through it. And I think when people see it, it sort of exceeds expectations. A lot of people are thinking of a sort of a little side shop, and they walk through and it's a state-of-the-art carbon fiber manufacturing facility that could be making lacrosse handles or could be making a part for the, you know, for the Bowen Dreamliner. It's literally, that's the level of expertise that we're bringing to the table here.
That was the part that was so interesting to me. You know, I think that the idea of having a front office for Epic that, you know, focuses on brand development, sales and marketing, you know, content creation, a lot of different, for lack of a better way of putting it, creative endeavors side by side with a manufacturing facility creates so much positive dynamic, creates such a positive dynamic in terms of the understanding of work and the understanding of how to build an office culture and making sure that everybody, you know, has a respect for the operations soup to nuts. And so, you know, it's a really fascinating process to see firsthand. And it would be very difficult to try to communicate, I think, on a podcast what it looks like. But yep. I think that it's easy to understand that, you know, having folks who specialize in wildly different elements of work when they go to their job every day is really valuable. So, One of the things that you touched on that transitions nicely into a comment that I wanted to ask you about that almost seems like a James Maselli mantra is you mentioned that there was composite technology in the 2016 NCAA championship game. And one of the things that you've carried over from your days selling sponsorships for NASCAR, which we didn't talk about this, but I know is a part of your background, was win on Sunday, sell on Monday. And the question is put very simply, how has that influenced your career and your relationship with making decisions within the lacrosse industry?
So just for a point of clarification, you know, I worked in the sponsorship and sales office for NASCAR. It was started off as an internship and then a very entry-level job. So, but I was a NASCAR fan. So I certainly got my, I got involved in a lot of things that maybe a typical intern wouldn't have. Only because I had a passion for the sport itself, and you're correct. There was the term was win on Sunday, sell on Monday, and you know if the Chevy Monte Carlo, driven by Dale Earnhardt, you know won the Daytona 500, there's a good chance if you walked into your Chevy dealer on Tuesday, they were all sold out. You know the sport was sort of driven by the star athletes and their choices of product, really influenced consumer behavior. I think probably one of the greatest sort of case studies in that is when a driver named Darrell Waltrip drove a car that was painted and decaled with Tide detergent. The amount of women that joined the sport in terms of fans and the sales of Tide detergent for Procter & Gamble that year were just off the charts. And it kind of talked about brand loyalty at the highest level. I think at lacrosse, we don't really have that sort of dynamic. I think the influencers in the sport are still coaches, teammates, influencers in the local market and community. I know when I went to lacrosse camp and I looked up to, you know, Gordon Purdy. Gordon Purdy was an Adelphi guy, Division I player at the time, and you know, he had a really funny accent from Australia and he was the kid that, you know, at camp, everybody wanted to play and be like Gordon Purdy and I was no different. But he was sort of local in my community. He was, you know, a local guy at Adelphi and, you know, if he used the Excalibur, that's what I was using. And I think that's still true today. I think you have exceptions to the rules. Like in my area, you had the Gate brothers and people wanted what the Gates were doing. And you sort of grew up with the Charlie Lockwoods and the Powells over at Cuse. And then I think today you have the Paul Rabels of the world and, you know, the John Grant Juniors. And I think if they're using a certain product, I think people are going to be influenced it, but I don't think it's the end all be all. I think products still need to prove themselves out locally to local coaches, to the local high school star, to the college player who is coming back to coach during the summer. I still think that that's the main driver for product adoption, and it's not really being driven by the glitz and glamour of ESPN or the pro leagues. I say that sort of tongue in cheek as this morning we're making an announcement of actually sponsoring the NLL and being an official equipment supplier. So I don't think I don't think it happens at all, but I still think the main driver is sort of locally in the community. But as the delivery of content becomes better, I do think there will be a time where the pro leagues will have a really nice influence of consumer behavior, especially if it's an open environment. If the sponsorships are exclusive to one or two manufacturers, I think I always say our consumers are the smartest in the world that they ever been. Our consumers today are better educated. I think they know what it takes to be in a league. And if it's really sort of narrow versus deep, then I think consumers know that there's a play to pay. But I think if it's opened up and there's a broad range of different types of manufacturers, some that may have a sneaker company or developing sneakers as their primary focus, down to companies like Epic that primary focus is lacrosse, I think consumers will see the value in that and at least make the product, it at least be on their radar to say, hey, I want to try that. But I don't think it's at the point where if someone scores a game-winning goal, you know, on TV that next day, that head's going to sell out. I think it's part of the purchase decision, but I don't think it's the finite point of decision that we saw in NASCAR. So that was really long-winded way to answer your question.
No, well, it's an interesting. It was certainly very deep, but I wanted to follow up by asking. So you touched on a handful of things that you could characterize as being problems with or flaws within the sport or the industry surrounding the sport of lacrosse, but there wasn't necessarily like a preeminent judgment attached to it. So, you know, as we start to wind down this conversation, I want to ask, you know, folks that are involved in lacrosse professionally have probably sensed a little bit of a tide shift over the last 18 months, and it's been multi-directional. In one respect, I think that there was a overall sense of pessimism with, you know, that reflected maybe some plateauing participation growth rates and certainly a lot of the tumultuousness within the retail and manufacturing industry. But then I also think that, you know, there's a certain optimism about coming away from whatever tumult existed, you know, particularly for those that remain. I want to, you know, at the risk of being negative, ask you the negative question, which is, what do you view, or what in your opinion is the largest or most significant challenge facing lacrosse, either as a sport or as an industry?
Terry, I think that's a great question. And it's certainly something that I've recently spent some time thinking about as I'm sort of getting involved in different sort of councils where, you know, industry comes together and we talk about the sport and what could be done. And I'm getting exposed to some really good thought leaders that are sort of bringing things to our attention that maybe I haven't looked at in the best possible way. But I'll be honest, you know, I was just recently with U.S. Lacrosse and they had a industry council come together. We were talking about this very topic. You know, what is it going to take to the sport to continue its momentum? And I'll be honest, Joe DeSimone of Lacrosse Limited made a fantastic point. It's not so much trying to get new people to try our sport, it's trying to keep people in the sport. And, you know, if some of the numbers that are being thrown around are accurate, it is pretty, pretty scary. Where, you know, for instance, you may have 120,000 people every year trying the sport, but you also have 100,000 leaving. So you have a net gain of 20,000. Those are startling numbers. You know, I was exposed to the hockey community here in Minnesota, and these are lifers. Most of the players know that they're not going to make the NHL or even a, you know, big time school, but they play for love of the game, and whether they're the best on the bench or the you know, the worst on the bench, they share a passion. There's a mutual respect for the different players. And they continue to play until they're 65, 70 years old. Lacrosse, we tend to play, and if we're playing club and we didn't get picked for the A team, our enthusiasm for the game wanes, and there's an opportunity. You know, we may not play. We may not play high school. Our buddies are on the A team. I'm on the B team. It, you know, that the love of the game is maybe being overshadowed by, you know, not being on the premier select team. And I'm not a downer on a club at all. I'm a bit of a downer on early recruitment, but club ball and getting exposure and playing more and having the game taught the right way. There's a lot of clubs out there that are doing some really nice things and teach the game the right way, and I think there's tremendous value there. I think the early recruiting thing, which we can probably do 6 podcasts on, is something I do have concerns with. But how do we develop our game to, if you don't end up going to Notre Dame, that you can still play club ball and it's organized and it's respected? And then also, it seems like in this sport, we do have this badge of honor that, you know, after 4 years of college, it's like, oh, I'm done, I'm hanging them up. How do we keep people in the game longer and have more rec leagues and, you know, have people playing the game until they're 65, whether it's modified or we take out, you know, the extreme body check? And I don't know the answers. I don't. All I know is that with so many people exiting the game every year, if we could just find a way to keep 50% of those in, you know, our growth numbers are going to look pretty strong. So that's the one that kind of concerns me. You know, as a business owner, it'd be nice for, you know, people who are 50, 60 years old. I mean, if somebody's going to purchase a stick four or five more times in their lifetime, throughout their career, that obviously helps the bottom line. But truthfully, my concern is being driven more by, you know, the game I love, that, you know, I want to see it be healthy, and I want to see it grow, and I want to see the performance on the field continue to elevate in a way that I believe it has. I believe there are some naysayers out there who think our game is not as good as it was in the 80s. I tend to disagree. I think our game is a beautiful game. I think the skills of the individuals and the teams is outstanding. It's at a high level. And whether technology has something to do with that, or just kids are playing more and they're getting more control of the ball and the stick, it's probably a little bit of both. But I think the game is great. I thought last season was one of the best seasons that I've seen in a long time. You know, with maybe some of the rules changes, but I think our game, from a performance standpoint, is in a beautiful spot. I'd like to see people stay in the game longer, play longer, and have that sort of outlet to be involved in a game longer than, you know, it's, you know, the college experience.
It's a great answer. It definitely touches on one of my biggest passion points, or points of emphasis, or even contention, as it relates to strategies for continuing to develop not just the growth of lacrosse, but the health of lacrosse overall. And it's that idea of lacrosse ought to be a lifetime sport, and for very many people it is. But in so many ways that basketball and soccer, and to your point, hockey, have utilized the massive growth of adult social rec leagues in cities across the country, I think that lacrosse has an opportunity to utilize all of the fun and excitement of playing the game, as well as the intrigue of how to throw and catch for newcomers, to be, you know, a sport that people continue to play at varying degrees of skill levels and seriousness, you know, from age 23 on. And I would love to see some strategies developed around how to actually bring that to fruition.
I think the box game could help that. Smaller field, more touches, you know, maybe less players, a little more action. I think if we can find a way to make the box game a little bit more, rec, you know, I think there's an opportunity there. But again, that could be another six podcasts.
Well, I'll go one step further. I'm a huge proponent of 3-on-3 lacrosse, whether it's speed or 3x or, you know, any of the other many incarnations under different titles. I think that is where, you know, there's tremendous opportunity for, you know, here in Baltimore, there are a couple, you know, Baltimore Sports and Social Club, a number of those post-collegiate rec leagues. And I think 3-on-3 lacrosse is a perfect fit for those models, particularly in markets like this, where there's a lot of former lacrosse players who would probably be interested in a co-ed outlet to, you know, be able to run up and down the field for 20 to 35 minutes, you know, throw a few BTBs and, you know, work up enough of a sweat to justify go getting a beer afterwards.
Yeah, I would agree with you, as long as we don't overcomplicate it with crazy rules. I think it needs to be like kind of like pickup basketball, where maybe you call your own fouls, and if a referee doesn't show up, you still play, and you can improvise. So if it happens to be, you know, there's no indoor fields, but you can go find a nice piece of concrete, you know, how can you improvise, you know, like play like trash can or something like that. As long as there's a freedom and it's sort of organic, I agree 100%. I think if we try to put, you know, a rule book around it and dimensions and referees and coaches, I think we go back to where we are today.
And I think that touches on the other comment that you made with relationship to why so many folks, particularly, you know, young kids, enter and leave the sport so quickly. And it's because I think so frequently it's positioned as a transactional thing. You play lacrosse so that you can get an opportunity to play in college. And if you, after a year, realize that that's not realistic, then you undercut the value or the prospect of why you wanted to play in the first place. Whereas, you know, if we as folks talking about lacrosse do a better job of saying, you play lacrosse because it's really fun. And, you know, we want to promote how many people have the opportunity to have fun playing lacrosse, forget about what it could do for you in your life down the road. You know, maybe we help to center ourselves on what a sport should be. You know, James, we've covered a lot of ground, and I really, really appreciate your time, and I want to bring this in for a landing by coming all the way back to the beginning, and that's a question about you individually, and it has a lot to do with, I think, how, you know, folks regard work, regard entrepreneurship, regard the passion of taking something that was a huge part of your life and making it your career. And my question is, you know, what do you see as being next? And as you analyze, you know, you mentioned you're a tick under 40, as you analyze, you know, what the next 10 to 20 years might hold in store for you, what do you envision?
So yeah, I'm a tick under 40, but sometimes I wake up and I feel like I'm 17. So that could be a good thing or a bad thing. You know, we have a very clear vision at Epic that we haven't shared with many people outside of our four walls, but we started about 3 years ago. We called our 2020 vision, and it's you know, what is lacrosse going to look like in the year 2020, and then how can Epic be the company that sort of brings that to fruition? The other side of that is all the business stuff that goes with it. How many employees do we need? What size space do we need? You know, when do we start team sales? When do we introduce protective? There's lots of sort of elements that kind of go with it. And I always caution people that, you know, our 2020 vision, which was a process that we went through that took about 6 months of intense brainstorming, organization, trying to detail out what can happen in the lacrosse space. What does our sport need from an equipment standpoint? And we basically took all that information, sifted through it, and came up with what we call our hero image. And it's basically, this is what the lacrosse player is going to look like in the year 2020. And we have that image in our you know, core mission and vision and core values are all sort of lined up to get us to that point. But our stated goal is that we want to compete from head to toe with every brand out there. You know, so in terms of you know, Epic, where we're at today, we're literally just getting started. Just as we introduced our Integra Protective line, now is really the first time that we can begin a team sales process so we can outfit teams. In the past, we've been selling one shaft to one kid at one time. You know, now we're talking to teams and organizations, and you know, the brand is starting to grow with that. But we know from a product dev standpoint, you know, there's products and other avenues that we want to be involved in that we're monitoring and we're developing, and you know, actively, some passively. Again, we want to compete against everybody out there from head to toe. So I don't think there's a finish line for us yet. I don't think we're looking at and say, hey, we get to this point, it's done. There's some technologies that we'll be introducing in the, you know, the next, you know, 3 to 6 months that we believe are fundamental to our growth and to continue to take a leadership position in technology and innovation. And we're excited to introduce those parts and those products. In order to get to the head to toe, we have a lot of work to do, and you know, we're well capitalized, and we are investing what I believe is in the right places so that we can get to that point. But you know, in terms of there's no end in sight for us. In terms of me in particular, I hope I'm doing this until I'm 90. I never want to stop doing this. I think I have the greatest job in the world. I get to design, build, and sell lacrosse equipment on a daily basis. If I go back to those sketches that I talked about, I'm doing what I dreamt about, you know, 30 years ago. Maybe more than 30, but you know, let's keep it nice, about 30 years ago. And then, you know, the other thing is too, is there's a philosophy that I have, and it jumps over into coaching, is that, you know, you leave things better than you found it. And I believe that, the talent that we're bringing in, that we have in house right now, that are you know, in some cases, almost half my age. These are the bright light bulbs. These are the guys that, you know, we're going to take over the reins. And I'm sure there'll be a point in time where, you know, the old man, me, is going to have to get out of the way and maybe be more of an advisor as opposed to in the trenches. But, you know, the talent that we have and you know, the Ryan Hurleys of the world, the Brian Hockmans, Jason Daniel on our product development side, Emily Fahn, who we just gave our first ever MVP Teammate of the Year award. She got the Epic Golden Glove. Will Drew, she makes our videos. I mean, I can go on and on and go through every single person. But that's who Epic is. Epic isn't James Maselli. I'm the one that gets in, does the podcast and does all the interviews and stuff, because they're the ones actually working and getting stuff done. And it's their company. And, you know, like I said, there's going to be a point in time where they're going to kick the old man aside and they might have a new direction or new ideas that they want to bring to the forefront. And when that time's right, I'm going to let them. It's their company. Let them take it and take it to the next level. So I'm hoping that I can leave it better than I found it. And there'll be a point in time where I'll get to hang back with my kids and God willing, hopefully grandkids one day, and I'll be old and gray, and I'll be happy, and that's okay.
What a note to end on.
What, being old and gray?
Well, being happy, man. That's what it's all about. And I really appreciate it. This conversation certainly made me happy. I really enjoyed your time. And for those of you listening who enjoyed this, certainly we all owe a debt to James for sharing a lot of insight, both in terms of his own professional development as well as into Epic Lacrosse's and how he views the lacrosse landscape. If the conversation piqued your interest, take a look at insidelacrosse.com/summit as we prepare for the second Lacrosse Industry Summit. It will be January 19th, 2017 at the Hilton Baltimore. That is the Thursday before LaxCon. So if you are coming to Baltimore for the U.S. Lacrosse Convention, please give the summit a look. I can assure you that it will be worth your while. We have an announcement. The first round of panel conversations and panelists will be debuting on InsideLacrosse.com this week. And check back next week as we bring you the second conversation in the run-up to the second Inside Lacrosse Industry Summit podcast series. Thank you so much for your time, and we will check back next week.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.